Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Since we first learned of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the United States, Americans have been focused on models for disease progression. We learned how our behavior could flatten the curve, meaning keep more people healthy for longer so healthcare workers could prepare for surges at local hospitals. Surge modeling has not been without controversy or confusion. Dr. David Basil is Vice President for Clinical Quality with Avera Medical Group, and he joins us now to help us understand the models and what they're telling us. Dr. Basil, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's just start with, for so many people, these models and these charts and these curves were brand new to begin with. And we tried to understand the things that that were immediate. Now we're several weeks into this, a couple months into this. So when you explain these models to people, tell us the overview of how we should look at some of this information. What exactly is surge modeling?
So really what surge modeling is based off of, and it's been around quite a long time, based off of looking at things like influenza, SARS, MERS virus, Ebola, all of those type of things. And they've been refined at looking how those spread. And they're really based off of kind of the concept of how many people does one positive person transmit it to, and then how long does it transmit it to that individual group of people, and then how long does the disease last after they get it? Because how exponential will this grow over a period of time, and how fast will that happen? Because number one reason or what thing that we're trying to use the surge modeling for is, are we going to overwhelm the hospital systems or not? Are we going to fill up the ICUs? Are we going to fill up the beds? Are we going to have enough of everything healthcare related to care for these individuals? And to what do we have to do to keep underneath that level? Because when, as you talked about, when we ran those first models, looking at the rate of spread injuries and even the initial outbreaks on the coast here, that number of person gives it to was really pretty high, in that, you know, 2.5 person that you spread it to on average. And that puts us, you know, over hospital capacities in almost all areas type of thing. And so, and we saw that, you know, here locally through the second half of March and the first half of April, you know, we were doubling, you know, every 3, 4, 5 days, which is on that same trajectory that we were all getting rapidly concerned. And then time, then, you know, the response to that is we can't allow the hospital system to get overwhelmed. That's when all of the sorting and all of the kind of unprecedented measures took place to prevent that from happening. And wonderfully, they were wildly successful. And so we were able to drop that number of people that each person spreads it to down, you know, from that 2.5 range, probably down to more like a 1.5 range, and really slow this disease down and give us time for the hospital systems to get their feet under them. And so a lot of the confusion now is, how come we didn't hit those numbers? Because we were successful at stopping the spread of this and getting it under control at this point. And so,
and I think that's an important point to make here, because many people coming off of the 2016 election were looking at poll numbers, and then after the election said, oh, the poll numbers were wrong, and they remember that. This is an entirely different thing. Those model numbers weren't wrong. They changed because we changed our behavior. So talk a little more about that the model will continue to change, and that's a good thing. Hopefully, it could be a good thing, but it also could go the other way, right?
Right. It's remarkable how much of a difference it makes between you think the difference between I get sick today, if I give that to, on average, 2.5 people versus one just less person that I come with, and I only give it to 1.5 people, that makes it's like money. It makes such a huge difference that one person change totally flat of a hump when you do that. It doesn't sound like much, but little changes like that just have a big impact on how long it takes this to grow and gives us the ability to almost choke it out. And so now we're in a situation that I talk about because of those changes. We haven't eradicated COVID. An analogy I've started using now is that we've got all these smoldering fires of COVID kind of burning underneath the surface a little bit here. And we're going to keep seeing these flare. And I say you're going to have like a flare up of a dumpster fire here and a dumpster fire there flare up and another dumpster fire over here. And if we can recognize those dumpster fires early, get in there with good contact tracing, good measures on a more localized effort wherever that flare up is, get it tamped back down, then we're going to be good. If we aren't able to do a good job of that, all those dumpster fires are going to coalesce and go back into a full-fledged prairie fire again, which would be bad. And so that's kind of the new kind of analogy that I'm using, is because we're going to see these flares. This community is going to flare, or this part of this community flare, or this little side population kind of flare. And can we get that back under control quickly enough before it spreads elsewhere? Type going to be the new fight for us.
Right. What are we seeing about the peak in South Dakota of cases? And before we talk about that, it's important also, I think, to make the connection. And here's my question. How closely is the death rate tied to the surge capacity? Because in some ways, you know, it's easy to get stuck thinking, well, if the hospitals can meet the need, is that lower the death rate? Then, if hospitals can meet the needs significantly, that's a broader measuring stick than I think most people realize.
Right, and so a couple assumptions here is that we're kind of a vaccine for probably 18 months, most likely. And so, if we think at 18, we go slow or fast, about the same percentage of people will get infected with this over time. That probably means that the same number of people will die, whether we go slow or fast, unless you start to overwhelm the hospital system. Because that's when, you know, if there's not enough ventilators to go around, if there's not enough nursing staff to go around, that's when things start to break down. And then we have a lot more deaths than we would have had otherwise. And that's that whole surge protecting, you know, don't get near to the capacity of the hospital system when things start to break down. If you can keep it underneath that, then you're right. The overall mortality is still going to be high. I mean, there's no way that's going to kill, you know, 5 to 10 times as many people just as a regular flu year. These are, you know, incredible, unprecedented steps we've taken. It's still going to kill 5 or 10 times as many as flu. We just can't get away from that. But we don't want to have to have it kill more than it needs to, I guess I'd say.
All right. So what do we know about the coming cases and when we might see a peak? What are we looking at today?
Yeah, so that's the good question. Now it comes to it's a lot harder to predict today than a month ago, because now we don't know, as things get opened back up, how much have we changed the public? You know, how much social distancing is now ingrained in us? You know, how much are we going to stay away from our neighbors, or how much when we talk to our neighbors are we going to be talking from 6 feet away instead of 1 feet away when we talk to them? How much less are we going to be shaking hands and stuff, even though as we're going back to work and stuff? And that's the thing that we just don't know. And that's what's going to make the difference on whether we have, you know, these little dumpster fires, or is it going to coalesce a true prairie fire surge? And that's, at this point, going to be very difficult to say. And it takes 2 or 3 weeks on every one of these changes, probably more like 3, before you start to see how effective steps taking and how fast do we start back up again. I'm sure we're going to see numbers rise again with everything opening back up again. It's a matter of how high, and that depends on, you know, how good people are at what social distancing you can still do when you're going back to work and everything.
When you said 5 to 10 times as many people will die as with a regular flu season, how many, when you look at the data today, how many people are going to die? What are those numbers? What are we projecting?
So regular flu season is about 20 people in the U.S. And so most of the numbers I've looked at are somewhere, you know, north of 100,000. And I think we're already up around 50, 60,000 right now. I haven't looked at the numbers the last couple of days. It'll be north of probably 100,000 in the U.S.
And in South Dakota?
Yeah, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I probably should have looked at those. So,
yeah.
It's still, what do we usually have? 100 people die of influenza a year. I better not spout numbers.
Right. Well, we won't guess. Yeah. we won't guess with those numbers. But I guess my question gets at the heart of not forgetting that this is a pretty significant thing, because as the weather gets nice and as people figure out things they can do and they cannot, we're having a hard time making decisions because we don't know what's at stake behind some of these decisions. So what's your recommendation for people who are kind of lost in the data a little bit and trying to figure out, well, does that mean I can go to the store? Does that mean I can't go to the park? Like, how do you balance the science of this with daily living?
Yeah, and so I've always been, because of the uncertainty and how much of these changes are going to be, you know, I've always been a proponent of let's do this in stages. And so what I've done with my own family right now, as opposed to going from the weeks where my kids have seen nobody else, you know, in the neighborhood, we've gone to, okay, for the next couple of weeks, up our circle of friends to a select group of people, you know, and okay, so my sister-in-law and her family live three blocks away. We'll open up to them and give the kids, you know, one or two friends that they can play with each, but not going to allow them to go to some big sleepover or something like that. We're going to go to the grocery store, but I'm going to wear a mask and I'm going to try to go not at a peak time when there's fewer people around. And so try to take some of those common sense things. Give that about 3 weeks, see what the numbers, if it seems like we've got enough social distancing, the numbers aren't rising too fast, then we can take a next step and a little bit more adventuresome. And so that's kind of how I'm approaching it with my family and with my employees and stuff. We're trying to do it in a stepwise fashion, give it a little bit of time, see what the effect of that is overall, and then take that next step from there as we see how this goes.
Yeah. Any advice before I let you go, Dr. Basil, about the different models that are coming out and people not really knowing everything from the South Dakota Department of Health that they would like to know? Some of our questions have not been answered about the assumptions that are being made for that modeling. And meanwhile, there are models from, you know, the University of Washington and Columbia University and other organizations. Where should people look to get that information and feel confident about the surge modeling that they're looking at to make decisions about South Dakota?
So really the most objective thing that we have to follow, and what I pay the most attention to myself, is the hospitalization count. Because, you know, how many positive tests you have depends on how many people you test. And so that number can vary widely depending upon what the current testing strategies are and how many, you know, what the supply of tests are and things like that. So I don't pay as much attention to the number of tests. I pay the most attention to the number of hospitalizations. That's the most information of what's going on in the community at any given time and what direction things are heading. Most of the models are based off of as well as the hospitalizations. And so I would say if you want to see kind of where things are trajectory-wise, follow the number of hospitalizations in the state and duties within the state, because that's going to tell you kind of what trajectory we're on, at least in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks out type of thing. Okay. But it takes probably 3 weeks for a number of hospitalizations to start to adjust as we open things up and stuff. So with the governor's press conference last week, it's going to be another good at least 2 weeks before we start to see how much hospitalizations increase in response to that. And so we'll just have to watch that and follow, check the hospitalizations, my advice.
Yeah. Dr. David Basil is Vice President for Clinical Quality with Avera Medical Group. Thank you so much for being here. We look forward to talking to you again.
All right. Thank you for having me.